Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the health care they need. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. Today on our show, we return to the night of December 10th, 2015, when a medevac helicopter crashed near McFarland, killing four people. The National Transportation Safety Board has released its findings. We'll take you through the report. I'm Laura Tsui.
And I'm Alice Daniel. We also meet a young mariachi singer from Delano, who's just released her first album. And now she's headed to Harvard.
But first, let's turn to this week's news. Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer is on the defensive after ABC 30 published a body cam video showing a police officer punching a teenager during an arrest earlier this year. The teenager has filed a lawsuit alleging excessive use of force. 17-year-old London Wallace had just been patted down when an officer grabbed his arm, pushed him against the wall, and began punching him. Here's Dyer during a press conference Wednesday.
The video that I have reviewed certainly raises concerns and raises questions for me as a police chief.
Wallace was arrested at the time for resisting arrest, but police later dropped all charges against him. Dyer promised a thorough review to hopefully be wrapped up within 30 days. He did say an earlier use of force review of the incident did not include any body cam footage.
Illegal marijuana grows on California's public lands, many tied to Mexican drug cartels, aren't new. And the environmental consequences, clear-cutting, stream diversion, the killing of wildlife, continue. What's changed, federal and state officials announced this week, is the increased use of highly toxic and illegal pesticides, like carbofuran. Here's U.S. Attorney McGregor Scott.
There is every reason to believe that this marijuana that is being grown illegally in the federal public lands is absorbing that carbofuran, and it doesn't just go away. So the end product that is being consumed by marijuana smokers, in all likelihood, contains carbofuran.
Most of the contaminated, unregulated, and untested marijuana will likely end up in places like Chicago, New York, and Atlanta. Scott says California is the source nation for marijuana in the United States.
As part of the state's process to ban the pesticide chlorpyrifos, which can cause neurological problems in children, the Department of Pesticide Regulation announced it's created a working group to find alternatives to the chemical. Many of the group's 18 members hail from the Valley Ag community, including David Haviland, a farm advisor with the UC Cooperative Extension in Bakersfield. He says growers have made great progress in reducing chlorpyrifos use on some pests, but the peskier ones still require reliable alternatives.
It's these last few pests that this working group's really going to try to figure out how we can solve.
The state also promised to work with ag commissioners and industry representatives to help in the transition away from chlorpyrifos.
Listen for more FM 89 news every weekday during Morning Edition and All Things Considered.
Espérame en el cielo, corazón, si es que te vas primero.
That's the sound of 18-year-old Delano musician Anaí Morales. She's just released her first mariachi album. You're hearing the album's title song, Espérame en el cielo. Valley Public Radio's Monica Velas takes us to where Morales grew up.
Morales was just six when she joined her first mariachi band. She plays the violin, guitar, guitarrón, and trumpet.
I would say it's like a lifestyle, you know? Because if I'm not teaching it or performing it, I'm singing it in the shower, I'm singing it while I clean the house, you know, it's always there.
On this summer day, she's getting ready to sing at the dining room table. But first she has to quiet her dogs. And make sure she's in the right key by playing the beginning of the music to the song, Nuestro Gran Amor, off of her phone. Then she sings a cappella.
Como el sol, le hace falta la luna, pues sin él no podría darnos luz.
The record label is Little Village Foundation. It's a nonprofit organization that seeks out artists from many different musical and cultural traditions who might not be heard outside of their communities, and it produces their music at no expense. But Morales has been heard. She's traveled around the country performing with a Delano band called Mariachi Mestizos. For a long time, she dreamed about singing in one particular place.
I used to have a poster of Carnegie Hall in my room, and it was like Carnegie Hall from the perspective of you on the stage. So you just see all the seats and the lights and everything.
And on April 10th, 2017, she made it to that stage.
And it was epic, like just extremely beautiful. Like the colors, I don't know, it literally felt like magic, just like looking at it.
She watched from the side as the seats filled up, and soon the lights were shining on her face.
I just told myself, okay, like, you're only gonna do this once. You gotta give it all you got and try to remember every moment of it.
And there's another more recent memory she'll never forget, the day she got accepted to Harvard.
When I looked at the screen, I saw it like throws confetti on the screen when you open it. And so I saw that and I was like, wait, what? Like,
that's good.
Yeah. I was like really, I was just like shook, you know? And my sisters were on FaceTime.
Morales says she was crying. Her two sisters were crying and her parents were screaming. One of her sisters is already at Harvard. And Morales says she's excited to be in the same place with her again. That sister is also a musician, and together they're going to play at Harvard's Mariachi Club.
So we're going to take it over this year, me and her together.
And she can also share her new album. It's a compilation of 13 of her favorite cover songs, plus one song that her dad wrote about the first time it snowed in Kern County. You're hearing that song now. Her dad, Juan Morales, runs a mariachi studio in Delano. That's where she recorded the album. Juan says the record started only with her voice and a guitar.
And then they said, well, why don't you play this song with the harp? Oh, okay, I'll play the harp. And I play the harp with another song. And then, why don't we add two violins? Okay, well, let's do two violins. And, well, let's put trumpet here. And why don't we use the mariachi? And all of a sudden, there's a 30-piece orchestra.
Before moving to the Valley, Juan played in professional mariachis around the world. He was in Los Camperos, Mariachi Cobre, and La Mariachi Sol de Mexico. He also taught it to all three of his daughters, the two going to Harvard and another who now lives in L.A. She's a director at a music school. Juan says it all started before they were born.
We used to play music in the womb for them. And my wife would put some contraption that we designed, and we played music, you know, constantly while they were being made.
It had a lasting effect. The family still plays together.
The most exciting thing is that we get to spend the evenings together, you know, my wife and I and our kids. We've been fortunate to have, you know, this opportunity for our girls.
And everyone in the family has taught in the mariachi studio. Anani Morales says she tells her students to challenge themselves in everything they do.
The second that it's easy, you're not learning anything. You're not growing from it. And so that's the advice I would give to anyone who wants to do anything, you know? It's just, you have to make sure that you always challenge yourself so that you can grow. Por la blanda arena
que lame el mar. And as she heads to Harvard, she'll take that advice with her. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Monica Velez. Un sendero solo de pena y silencio llegó hasta el agua profunda. Un sendero solo de penas mudas llegó hasta
la... You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui.
And I'm Alice Daniel. Medevac helicopters transport patients to hospitals that can provide them with the best care. So when a helicopter meant to save lives crashes, it can feel doubly wrong. 4 years ago, a medevac helicopter crashed near McFarland, sent shockwaves through the first responder community, and made headlines all over the valley.
And we begin with developing news out of McFarland, where authorities are expected to release the names today of the four people killed last night in a medical helicopter crash.
Air traffic. That was from ABC 30 on December 11th, 2015. Four people, including the pilot, Thomas Hample, died. So how could this happen? Was the company negligent? Was there engine trouble? To try and answer these questions, the National Transportation Safety Board spent years investigating the crash. It only released its report in March.
Over the past few months, we've looked at the documents, from interviews with family members to employees, pilots, and executives from Rogers Helicopters, the company where Hample worked. Today, we're going to take you through the report with the help of an expert, Bill Withycombe. He's a retired pilot and former accident investigator for the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA.
The aircraft was examined very carefully to ensure that there were no mid-air collision with a bird or any sort of object.
According to the report, Hample left the Porterville Municipal Airport on December 10, 2015, just before 7 p.m. He was transporting a patient named Kathy Brown, who was experiencing head, shoulder, and arm pain, to a hospital in Bakersfield.
He actually filled out a pre-flight report that is required by the company to verify that the pilot is approving the various conditions under which he is going to be operating.
Pilots have to fill out risk assessment sheets to help decide how safe it is to fly. Hample's rating showed he thought it was safe to go. But he was certified to fly relying only on instruments in low visibility conditions. And not long after liftoff, that's what he encountered.
The first instinct for any pilot is to get out of bad weather, Withycombe says, and Hample started to make a turn to reverse course.
He was trying to do a 180-degree turn at fairly high airspeeds, and he somehow allowed himself to slip into a descent, probably getting confused because of the weather patterns that he was flying in, possibly heavy rain and maybe some fog, and lost his reference to the ground and also lost his reference to the instruments that were right in front of him and allowed that aircraft to hit the deck very hard.
That evening, Shelley Hample got a call from the company telling her that dispatch had lost contact with her husband. Her world was shattered 15 minutes later when she learned of the crash. She told a news station in Bend, Oregon, where she lived, that she had never thought this would happen. Her husband had been a pilot for more than 17 years and had flown all over the U.S.,
but he's our family and will be forever. I just won't be able to see him for a few years now.
Also on the flight were Marco Lopez, a nurse, and Kyle Juarez, a paramedic. At a press event the night after the crash, American Ambulance President Todd Valeri said they weren't even supposed to work that night, but they had switched with two other crew members.
Last night was our company Christmas party. And the crew that was assigned to work that helicopter that night wanted to attend.
So why did the pilot slip into a descent? Withycombe says the NTSB ruled out many factors.
There was no evidence of any engine failure, and there was also no evidence of any instrumentation problems that could have led to him not being able to control the aircraft.
The conclusion by the NTSB? The pilot lost control while attempting to reverse course in hilly terrain with reduced visibility. But contributing to that was, quote, the pilot's lack of recent experience with nighttime operations. Records show Hample lacked experience with this particular helicopter. It had newer technology, like electronic displays rather than analog dials and gauges. Still, Withycombe says that shouldn't have mattered.
He should have been, in my opinion, as an instrument-rated pilot, been able to use his skills by merely looking at the airspeed indicator, the attitude indicator in the cockpit, and being able to maintain his flight stability.
But other questions remain, too. Documents show that at least one former pilot, Seth Vello, told the NTSB in an email that, quote, there is a lack of training and pressure to fly in regards to weather, and that this accident was icing on the cake, comments Roger's helicopters disputed during the investigation. Vello now lives out of state and declined an interview request.
Both Vello and Hample's wife also told the NTSB that Hample wasn't comfortable flying at night without night vision goggles, nor had he completed the night vision goggle training. He wasn't wearing them on the night of the crash. But Withycombe says night vision goggles wouldn't have helped him see in the fog. The report did not show fault with Roger's helicopters. The company declined a request to be interviewed for this story.
Still, Withycombe says the FAA and the NTSB have implemented many changes in the medical helicopter industry in the past 5 years to make sure rescue operations like these are safer. So we asked him, what might be different if that flight was taken today?
This particular case, more flight time, more training in that particular helicopter than he had at the time. That, I'm sure, is still a focus of the company. Some of the report, I should say, had information in it that indicated that the company had actually implemented some safety requirements that were probably ahead of their time.
Requirements like filling out that risk assessment sheet Hample completed, indicating it was okay to fly. Fellow pilot Rob Moore trusted that decision.
On the night of the crash, Moore said in a statement he canceled a flight from Bakersfield to Fresno because of bad weather conditions. He said he spoke with Hample, who told Moore he had visibility from Porterville, but would carefully check the weather before his flight. Moore said, quote, Tom was a very thoughtful, safe pilot who was not a risk taker at all, and I knew he would make the correct decision.
But risk is hard to quantify, and even the right decisions can end in disaster. What exactly happened on the night of December 10th, 2015, is something only those in the helicopter could know.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Alice Daniel. Access to higher education has long been a part of the California dream. Now some state lawmakers want to bring college classes to young people while they're in juvenile detention facilities and help them continue on once they're out. And they're looking to the success of a program that's ahead of the curve. As part of the California Dream Collaboration, KQED's Vanessa Roncagno reports.
When parents arrive for high school graduation at San Mateo County Juvenile Hall, they pass through metal detectors and stash their cell phones in lockers.
When we come through this door, we're going to veer through the left.
They're ushered through a maze of corridors and locked doors until they reach the gym at the heart of the facility.
Hi, everyone. We're saving the first two rows for family. And then
the graduating class of 2019 enters the gym. The four of them, all young men, take their seats on the stage. They're dressed up in ties and khaki slacks under their purple gowns, identical county-issued white sneakers on their feet. 18-year-old Ramon, just his first name to protect his privacy, steps up to the mic.
We should leave here with the legacy of being kids who were at their worst and who then became successful in a way that led to our high school graduation.
The crowd reflects an unusual collaboration between county education officials, probation officers, local educators, and others, forged over years. Today is a victory for them, even if there are only four graduates.
Will the class of 2019 please stand?
After the ceremony, Ramon is outside the gym, holding a plate stacked with brightly frosted mini cupcakes.
I've been here already a year, and I got a year left. I've been incarcerated since I was 13.
By law, youth in California's juvenile detention facilities must have access to a high school education. But in San Mateo, the people gathered for this graduation have fought hard to make sure students get something more. Ramon not only finished his high school degree here, he also takes classes taught by local community college instructors. It's one of only a handful of programs of its kind in the state. And it was one of the very first.
When you're in your cell, it makes you feel better. You're looking forward to turning in your work and see what kind of grades you get.
Ramon has taken ethnic studies and psychology. He already has 7 college credits, transferable to a 4-year university.
It gave me an experience of college that made me feel good.
Even before kids like Ramon are released, the program, called Project Change, makes sure they're enrolled in community college. Once they're on campus, they get support through graduation.
It's the priority enrollment, the tuition, the counseling, assistance with transportation, it's the books.
Nick Jasso was locked up at San Mateo's juvenile hall back in 2012, and after his release, got referred to Project Change at College of San Mateo. He says the program gave him a new community when he needed one most.
After I started changing the way I live my life, the hardest part for me was just being like extremely lonely all the time. I couldn't hang around the people who were still like selling drugs. So I just had to be by myself, which was hard because it was the people that I grew up with. It was the people that I was closest to.
Jasso says he got pegged as a bad kid starting in elementary school. And it's how he came to see himself.
Because to me, like, school was a place where I went to get punished.
So when he got to college, the first thing he had to do was rebuild his relationship to school.
I'm not being followed around by school resource officers, and I'm not being harassed. Like, I'm just a student, and like, I get to just be a student.
Such a good student, he's transferring to UCLA this fall.
Nicholas Tyler Jefferson.
When he graduated from College of San Mateo this spring, his Project Change friends cheered louder than anyone else.
Magna cum laude.
He plans to keep working with formerly incarcerated students at UCLA. He's seen how fragile success can be.
I think the hardest thing about mentorship on the outside is seeing people go back inside. Incarceration is a trap. It's really hard to get out once you're in.
Hard for kids like Ramon at the San Mateo County Juvenile Hall. He turns 19 in a few months. Then he'll be transferred to county jail, where his future in higher education will be that much more uncertain. In San Mateo, I'm Vanessa Rancagno.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Alice Daniel. Less than 10 miles away from the epicenters of the two powerful earthquakes that shook the Ridgecrest area over Independence Day weekend lies a military base, Naval Air Weapon Station China Lake. It's huge. It's full of sensitive machinery and weapons. And earlier this month, the Navy revealed that it could cost up to $5 billion to repair all the damage done by the quakes. FM89's Carrie Klein is here to tell us a bit more about what happened and what those repairs could entail. First off, Carrie, what is Naval Air Weapon Station China Lake? What happens there?
So China Lake is part of the Naval Air Warfare Center Weapons Division, sometimes abbreviated NOCWD. That means China Lake is involved in researching, developing, and testing all sorts of weapons and aircraft for the Navy. They also develop cyber warfare. Here's a clip from a promotional video about the Navy's Weapons Division released last year, full of people in military fatigues and lab coats and virtual reality simulators.
Here's just some of the things we do.
We research and develop weapons that make the warfighter more lethal and rapidly develop capabilities that keep our armed forces ahead of the game.
Whether we're building a better bomb or designing a software interface, the warfighter comes first.
Every few years, China Lake or the wider NOCWD will release video excerpts from their weapons tests, with all manner of rockets and missiles being shot at drones and, conversely, aircraft dropping lots of explosives on targets on the ground. It's actually pretty spectacular.
So this is a really important place, and the base is really huge, right?
Yes, it's enormous. It's the Navy's biggest installation. It covers 20,000 square miles, which is bigger than the state of Rhode Island, and that leaves lots of space for really remote testing. But one thing I should point out here is that there is not any nuclear testing happening here. The internet is ablaze with rumors that underground testing of nukes actually caused the earthquakes. Those are just conspiracy theories. The U.S.'s last nuclear test took place in 1992, and there are monitors all over the place that would pick up if China Lake had resumed testing, even underground.
Okay, so that's good to know. But $5 billion in damage, that sounds like an awful lot. Did the earthquakes really cause that?
It does sound like an awful lot. That's the total replacement estimate, and it includes things like seismic upgrades and retrofits, which obviously are an upgrade to what was there before. So the actual damage estimate was less, but still topped $1 billion, which is still a lot. A China Lake representative wasn't able to arrange an interview, but the Navy Facilities Engineering Command Southwest, or NAVFAC for short, they shared a presentation online earlier this month with some details about what was lost. It looks like at least 800 buildings were damaged. 69 of them require more than $5 million each to repair or replace. The list of big buildings to demolish and fully replace is pretty long, and it includes two hangars, laboratories, an air traffic control tower, and a firing bay. Now, NAVFAC turned down an interview request, but here's its commanding officer, Captain Mark Adelson, speaking to industry representatives on August 1st.
Things got tweaked, the structural steel got damaged, the foundations got cracked, and it tended to be either in the older buildings, those two hangars I mentioned, the air traffic control tower, and certainly the things closer to the epicenter. So again,
so he's explaining a little bit about what actually happened on base. He also mentions the beams in one of the hangars simply snapped. A water main ruptured, leaking sprinklers caused water damage in many buildings. And he mentioned a chest of drawers in one of the residences literally flipped over onto its top.
Okay, so all of this information really begs the question, how can this happen? How can a naval base handling such sensitive material be so susceptible to earthquake damage?
I really wanted to know this too, and the answer seems to be pretty simple. The buildings were really old. The oldest were from the 1940s, like those big hangars, and so, of course, many had not been retrofitted to comply with modern seismic code. Not surprisingly, Adelson did say in his presentation that those buildings constructed after the 1989 Loma Prieta quake fared much better than the older buildings. So I still found all of this surprising, but a NAVFAC spokesperson told me that unless specifically required by law, there is no requirement to seismically retrofit older buildings every time there's a building code change. So, you know, even though that may legally be true, that does still strike me as risky for a weapon station with such sensitive material lying close to what is known as an active fault.
Wow. So with damage so extensive, is the base continuing with its mission?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I don't fully know the answer to that just yet. The base was initially evacuated after the second earthquake, but now all personnel are allowed back on base. During that August 1st presentation, Adelson said the base at that time was partially mission capable, though I haven't been able to confirm if it's gotten an upgrade since then. Adelson also said that a lot of operations in damaged buildings are piecing themselves together wherever they can elsewhere. So one entire unit had crowded itself into another office for the time being. There are some tents being put up in a few areas. But as to what exactly has been lost or delayed at China Lake, Adelson was light on details, though he did hint at how imperative it is to get everything back up and running.
Until I can get that place rebuilt, the laboratories rebuilt, the magazines rebuilt, the testing facilities rebuilt, the United States is losing a little momentum there. So that's
and as to whether or not there is any remaining danger on base, a NAVFAC spokesperson told me the Navy has taken precautions to mitigate the risk posed by any damaged structures.
Okay, so no funding is guaranteed until Congress appropriates money toward the base. So what are lawmakers saying?
Yeah, well, so I reached out to three federal lawmakers representing this region to get their takes. That's, of course, Congressman Kevin McCarthy in the House and Senators Dianne Feinstein and Kamala Harris. They all turned down interview requests, but did return written statements. All three said they'd push for the funds to rebuild the base. McCarthy in particular said he's been in regular contact with the Secretary of the Navy and other officials, and that he understands the value that China Lake brings to the community and to the nation. Kamala Harris also used this as an opportunity to speak out against President Trump, saying it's situations like this that show why it's irresponsible for the Trump administration to, quote, raid defense funds to build the president's vanity project of a border wall, end quote.
I'm curious, did any of them indicate any surprise with the $5 billion in damage?
No, none of them did, nor did they seem to question how a base of this stature could be vulnerable to such seismic damage.
All right, Carrie, I look forward to hearing more.
Thanks.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. State legislators have fast-tracked Senate Bill 1, the California Environmental, Public Health, and Workers' Defense Act of 2019. It is sweeping legislation that would lock current standards in place through January 20th, 2025, the last day of Donald Trump's presidency if he were to win a second term. Proponents see SB1 as an insurance policy against potential federal rollbacks of environmental and worker safety standards. But opponents say it could stall negotiations over water supplies and hurt farmers. Moderator Kathleen Schock spoke with advocates on both sides of the issue, John Harris of Harris Farms and Kim Delfino with Defenders of Wildlife. Dr. Lisa Bryant, assistant professor of political science at Fresno State, also joined the conversation.
So, Dr. Bryant, I'd like to start with you. You know, this is obviously a very politically driven bill. California Assemblymember Todd Gloria said in a statement, quote, "Despite the Trump administration's desire to roll back key protections for our environment and workers, California will not roll with them. SB1 is an essential piece of legislation that will ensure our environment and natural resources are preserved and our workers and consumers are protected, even if the federal government recklessly chooses to repeal these standards," unquote. So the political motivation is very upfront. I guess my first of two questions to you is this legal?
Yeah, most likely it is. So states have historically always been the implementer of federal plan, but they've also always been a driver of federal policy. And so lots of environmental policy has been created in California, especially. And the federal government can push back against it. There are some unique exceptions in the law. So, for example, the Clean Air Act of 1970 includes a California exception where California can make higher standards than the federal level because of California's sort of unique problems in terms of population, in terms of geography. And so they do have to apply for a permit to have higher standards than the federal government. But by and large, those permits have been granted to the state because of air quality requirements here. And so there is some precedent for California to be able to have higher standards than the federal government and for states to actually steer environmental policy.
So that was my follow-up question. This is not something that has come out of the blue. We've been here before.
Yeah, there's actually, if in the public policy arena, when you study environmental policy, there's sort of this idea we think about American exceptionalism in a lot of ways. Well, there's California exceptionalism in environmental policy. So the state has been a driver of environmental policy. If you think of, you know, emission standards for vehicles, all vehicles in the United States meet California emission requirements, right? Like Texas actually even cited this in getting rid of emissions testing because they said, well, California already requires it and all the vehicles come in and meet that standard, so we don't really need to impose this additional tax on our citizens, right? And so this standard has been a driver in terms of vehicle reforms, which, you know, I think we're hearing California talk about again, directly dealing with manufacturers to have stricter standards. And so, yeah, there's a lot of precedent for clean water, clean air being driven by California policy and then changing national policy down the road.
Great. So, John Harris, I'd like to shift the conversation to you. You've been an outspoken critic of SB1 on the grounds that, the most controversial aspect of the bill is that it would subject the Central Valley Project, which is a federal project, to California's endangered species law. Explain to us what this could mean for Valley farmers.
It has nothing to do with clean air at all. It's all about water standards. And it's really about how much water we can pump out of the canal that comes down from the delta. And that is controlled much by biological opinions of how those flows in the delta impact endangered species. So it's kind of a convoluted situation. But essentially, it's working now, and we're getting more water under the current rules than there were under the previous rules. And both rules are in compliance with the law. And I don't think tougher standards are inherently good for anyone. In this situation, they're worse. They're, you know, lesser benefit to people because you employ less people and you create less food supplies and the whole farm economy is impacted. So I think we need to have standards that allow us to, you know, pump much water south of the delta as we can. Not have standards that are unrealistic.
So, Kim Delfino, you're with Defenders of Wildlife, which has supported SB1. Do you agree that this is ultimately about water?
Well, in all honesty, the bill is much broader than water, but the controversy is centering around the water. So the bill has components in it that would maintain or try to maintain baseline minimum standards that the federal government had in effect before this new federal administration on air, on water quality, and on worker and health safety, and on endangered species protection. And as noted by Mr. Harris, that the controversy around SB 1 right now is focused on the rules around how we operate our federal and, well, really the federal water project and how it delivers water around the state. So that is the controversy, definitely. But I would say that, you know, I think there's good reason for the folks that are focused on having good rules on how we operate those projects, because we just saw a report released that shows that federal scientists had concluded that the new rules that we expect the federal government to release at the end of the month on how to govern the water project are weaker than previous rules. And in fact, they concluded that they would jeopardize the continued existence of winter run salmon and other species that utilize the Delta and the rivers that lead into the Delta. And so, yes, it will send more water south, but it will come at great expense to the Delta and to the people that rely on the Delta for their livelihood, such as salmon fishermen.
I'd like to continue with you. You know, you've been involved with the Environmental Species Act, with issues around the Environmental Species Act, I should say, for many years. How concerned are you about the impact of the rollback of regulations currently? How does this moment in time compare to what you've seen at other points in history?
It's fairly exceptional what we're looking at right now, sort of the juggernaut of rollbacks and changes that we're seeing, particularly with endangered species. I mean, we are already seeing them, of course, with clean air and clean water rules. But with endangered species, with the most recent release of the change in the rules on how the federal government applies the Endangered Species Act, it's unprecedented. And I mean, we see this happen. You know, the last time around under the Bush administration, we saw where there was an effort to weaken the rules on how to operate the water projects that ultimately was overturned by the court. But, you know, this time around, it's like I said, it's unprecedented in my 25 years of working on these issues.
So, John Harris, you're not only the chairman of Harris Farms, but also an active member of the Central Valley Business Federation. You know, you spoke earlier about this potentially impacting the economy of the Central Valley. Do you have any tangible evidence of what kind of actual impact we could expect to see in the event that SB1 does come into fruition?
The valley is really impacted. If we don't get sufficient water, and that can be due to, you know, other reasons as well, it's pretty conclusive that the valley economy benefits greatly from water coming from other areas.
So if you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm speaking with John Harris of Harris Farms. You know, I'm wondering, would you still support the main intent of the bill if the water regulations part was not included?
The bill probably tries to cover too much of the problem. And the other problem is it's going to get dealt with in the kind of waning hours of the legislature. And what comes out might not be really what anyone wants. I think they almost need to go back and start over.
Dr. Bryant, you're a professor of political science. What is your take on the law? Is it attempting to do too much at once?
Possibly, but the idea, I think, that they could go down and pull it out into, you know, smaller bills, exclusively water, exclusively endangered species, is, you know, you probably run a bigger risk of those pieces of legislation becoming even more contentious and even more stakeholders trying to dismantle or add in exactly what they want in each one of those bills. So sometimes these big bills that have a broad intent are easier to get passed. And so you allow more opportunity for people to contribute at this point rather than having, you know, it broken up. I think it probably stands a fairly good chance of passing here with the current legislative body that we have.
You know, Kim Delfino, I'd like to bring you back into the conversation. You know, obviously, detractors of SB 1 are quick to point out how politicized it is, and perhaps are inferring that environmentalists are taking advantage of this political climate to enact something that's rather sweeping and draconian in nature. How might you respond to that criticism?
I think it's kind of an ironic statement, because the reality is that we wouldn't even need this bill if the federal administration, which is very political, wasn't doing what they were doing right now, which is rolling back standards regarding our clean air, clean water, health and safety protections for workers, and endangered species protection. So the reality is that it was the politics at the federal level and the drive to dismantle our environmental protections that has led to the response here in California. Frankly, I'd like to be working on other things than having to try to restate or reinforce minimum federal protections. And I would just go back to a question you had asked about the economic cost to the valley. And believe me, I am not one. I live in Sacramento. I value agriculture and the agricultural history of our valley, and I believe it's very important. But the reality here is that all we're saying is that the rules that are in place right now, the minimum level of protection in place right now, which the agricultural economy is functioning with, that would remain in place. So what we're talking about is loosening up of restrictions that would cost salmon fishermen and the delta and other species and have a negative impact, would send more water south. So it's not an economic cost. It's just that the folks that are in Washington, D.C. right now, who are opposing this bill, but in D.C. weakening environmental protections, just don't want to see all of the work that they've done to weaken these protections get pushed back against by the state of California.
Mr. Harris, before we wrap up, I'd love for you to respond to that statement.
Well, it is a classic argument of fish versus people. I mean, that oversimplifies it. We all value species and want to protect them, but there's a balance, and it should be based on good science. And that's all we're asking, is that they use the latest science to determine what level to pump at. It depends on who's looking at it, I guess. But I think we do a lot of harm if we cut back on amount of water that can be pumped from the delta at a time that it's available and the agriculture and urban areas need it.
You referenced the use of old science. Can you unpack that a bit?
Well, there's new science showing that these biological opinions, which is, as I understand it, is saying, okay, you've got these flows in the delta. What happens under this? I mean, every day is different. It's sort of man-made. It's not a man-made situation. It's just, it depends on the way the water's flowing, how much in harm's way some of the smelt and salmon are placed. And what happens is they get eaten by some of these predator fish like the black striped bass. So there's so many stressors besides just the amount pumped. But the only thing that's dealt with is the amount pumped, and that's dealt with by these biological opinions, and we want to make sure they use the best science on those, not necessarily use science that was devised 10 years ago.
Well, I want to make sure we don't fall into the trap of oversimplifying this conversation and making it about, fish versus ag. But Kim Delfino, I would like to give you a chance to respond.
Sure. And I appreciate that. And I don't think this is fish versus agriculture. Like I said, you know, we want a thriving agricultural economy. The issue right now on the science is that, number one, the bill specifically gives a discretion to the Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Fish and Game Commission on what is the best science. It does. As opposed to what the opponents are saying, it definitely does not lock into place old science. And I would not want to lock in place old science. We want to have new science, and we want to be able to rely on the best science. I find it interesting that the opposition continues to point to the fact that they believe this bill would lock in old science, when there was just a story in the LA Times today documenting the initial biological opinion that the National Marine Fisheries Service was about to issue on the proposed new rules for the Federal Water Project, but got pulled back because National Marine Fisheries Service said that the new rules that the Bureau of Reclamation wanted to use would unequivocally jeopardize the continued existence of endangered winter-run salmon, spring-run Chinook, Central Valley steelhead, and southern resident killer whales, which is highly unusual for the federal government to actually conclude that there's going to be a jeopardy from the operations. That opinion got yanked back at the last minute and is now undergoing a quote-unquote review. And so, you know, I think there's this question where we are really concerned about the fact that the federal government itself is not going to be relying on the best science. And we'd prefer, in that case, to have this, the Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Fish and Game Commission decide, you know, best what's the best available science.
So we just have a couple minutes before we wrap up. Dr. Brian, I'd like to give you the last word. You said that Senate Bill 1 is likely to pass given the current makeup of California's legislative.
I said I thought I had a good chance. I think another thing, listening to the discussion of the other two guests, something that's important to stress is that states have always had the right to implement EPA policies, right? So when EPA's pass policies and regulations, so whether it's federal policy on how water is distributed, states propose a plan to the federal government. They say, this is how we're going to regulate it. This is how we're going to maintain it. This is what works best for our states, because all states and all regions are not the same. And so the idea that just because something is federal water, it doesn't mean that the feds always come in and regulate that water. States have often been the regulators of federal policy. And so, you know, I think that that's at play here, too. So.
But even if the bill passes, we could expect to see some legal challenges, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Great. Thank you all for being with us. We really appreciate your perspective.
Thank you for having
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
And now for the weekend. We're going to start off with a poem by writer and Fresno State professor Bryn Saito.
I'll read a poem called Stone in the Desert Camp 1942 that sort of draws on the history of the Japanese-American incarceration. I went to visit Manzanar a few years ago, and that landscape is, you know, littered with these stones, and the stones sort of started speaking to me. And these were some of the voices I heard in the stones that carried some of the stories of our elders.
All right.
Stone in the Desert Camp 1942. Between the Turtle Rock and the Crane Rock, the children found me, and I was shining and smooth and silent about my secrets. One day above me, men with bony shoulders came and built the barracks. Then I couldn't see the sky for the rising camps, and I couldn't feel the winds whipping between the ranges, and I couldn't see the ranges. After a short time, voices moved in, and I heard singing. Months later, dancing. But mostly what caught me was the quiet, concentrated chatter of elders. How long before a working stove? How to make a garden in this cradle of limestone? How to coax a stream from the highest of peaks and the freest of nations? In this nation we sought for the blinding. Some days no one heard the tears, but I felt them. They coated me like evidence of a prior. See, I thought this must be how the humans felt when the rains broke above them every 200 days and the waters for once didn't leak through their roofs and they were happy.
She'll be reading next Thursday at the San Joaquin River Parkway as part of their summer series, Respite by the River. We know Thursday's not quite the weekend, but it's close enough. I spoke with Saito about drawing on memory and family history and art and returning to Fresno. So, Britton, we've had you in to talk before about the Yonsei Memory Project, which you co-founded with Nikiko Masumoto. And in discussing that here, you said the phrase that art awakens the archives of memory. And I know the whole of Yonsei Memory Project was talking about generational experiences and also trauma and the incarceration of Japanese-American families. How does memory, not just your own, but maybe even your family's, come into your writing and your poetry?
Yeah, I definitely see my poem making as an extension of like memory work, I think. Poetry and arts sort of transmutes the energies of the past, the trauma that you mentioned. Poetry and art has a way of transmuting it and transforming it so it's not transmitted, which was a quote I heard from a Zen priest once, and I really loved that. So I do feel like my poetry still addresses those same themes and works with those same energies. Not even intentionally. It just sort of is what I'm drawn to and what comes out.
And so building off of that, you were featured in Vogue, along with Nikiko, actually, to talk about what you guys did in Yonsei Memory Project. And there were a number of other Japanese Americans in that particular feature story, talking about how
their family members were incarcerated and the work they're doing today to I guess, transform that experience into something different, something educational, or even just documenting it. Does the work that you do in storytelling, you know, in writing and in putting it down into something else, does that feel like it's finally become mainstream to talk about trauma and to say this is what happened?
More and more so, I think, because of this socio-political moment that we're in. There's so much going on. There's so many communities under duress, whether it's at the southern border or within our prison system or with the Muslim ban. There's so much happening right now that really called Nikiko and I to begin the work of Yonsei Memory Project and make connections between our history and the histories of those struggling very urgently at this moment. And I think the media, I think online community, there's more visibility now around these stories. There's more interest in making these sorts of connections. And the Vogue piece was wonderful because it gave us the visibility and it gave us an opportunity to both tell our stories, but then bring others into the mix as well, talk about other Japanese Americans and allies who are doing this memory work, who are doing this work of carrying forward the story. And it was just sort of, I guess with any big sort of magazine or publication like that, you get a certain level of visibility that allows you, opens up other doors. And so we're hoping that that continues to open up other doors for both Yonsei Memory Project and Nikiko and I as artists as well.
And you grew up in Fresno, but you've lived in New York, in the Bay Area, all these different places, and now you're back in Fresno, teaching at Fresno State. Is there a way that Fresno as a place, or maybe just your home, you know, where you grew up, influences your poetry?
Yeah, the valley is in my bones. It's in my bones and in my blood. And I think of great writers like Philip Levine or Juan Felipe Herrera or Shirley Ann Williams, Lawson Fusao Inada, this legacy of poets who just sang their stories of struggle and praise and joy. The stories were so rooted in the valley. When I was living in New York, I was pining for the valley. I was writing all these poems about dust and the fields and the orchards and the farms my parents grew up on and the labor. And I was missing that. Like that was just, those landscapes are just in us, you know, they're just in us. And I still can't help but write into those stories of my family's life here, the generations of my family in the valley, working this land, being here, building their families here, loving here. And it's been a real gift to have the opportunity to go away, to experience other landscapes and other people and other things, and now come home and sort of start to merge those two worlds and bring, just offer other things to, especially to my students, who I just had my first class this morning at Fresno State. Shout out to any students who are listening right now.
And so what are you excited about when it comes to reading at Respite by the River?
I love the whole spirit of the reading series, you know, sort of celebrating and honoring sort of the land and being a steward of the land. So many of my poems reckon with the landscape and think about the landscape of the valley. So I'm so excited to be sort of part of this lineup this summer, and the chance to bring in sort of music and poetry. I know Jeff Bowman, the musician, will be playing right before me. I love the intersection of arts, music, poetry, visual arts. So I think it'll be a very dynamic evening with music and poetry, and I hear wine is served, and which always helps us as poets to read to an audience that is, you know, joyful in those ways. So I think I'm just really looking forward to next Thursday night.
Thank you so much, Bryn.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook.
Don't forget to check out our app. It's called KVPR, and it's available for free on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by the KVPR News Team, Alice Daniel, Monica Velez,
Carrie Klein, and Laura Satsui. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Laura Satsui. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need. On the web at chcf.org.